So I'm gonna talk about sequential growth dynamics and quantum random walks. I think this is probably the only place in the world I would give this talk, both because there are a fair number of people in the audience who know about both of these topics, or at least one of these topics. And also because by the end of the talk, I'm gonna be speculating wildly, which, or at least wildly for someone who normally sits in a math department. But I can do that when I'm here, which is nice. Okay, so let me start right off by reminding you about a model of crystal growth that goes back 60 or 70 years. It may even be before Temperley, I don't know. I learned about it from Pasha Krapinski last year. So this is a model where you have a corner and molecules are accumulating there, or atoms are accumulating there. So think of it as a deposition process of some sort, or if you think of the white stuff as being matter, you can think of it as sort of a melting process coming away from the corner. The atoms are squares. They come in one at a time, and they have to fit into the corner, or a corner that's already there. They have to be supported. I've showed you the rule, and here's what it looks like if you run it for a lot of time steps. So the little squares accumulate in the corner, and they grow upward and upward. Each of the allowed transitions is happening with the same probability at each time step. So it seems to be developing some shape. It's certainly staying two-dimensional because that's the rules of the model. You can see that it seems to preferentially grow along the edges. If you think about that for a moment, you'll realize that has to happen because there's always a little corner there that a new square can fit into. So it is gonna grow preferentially along the sides. And it's developing this curving shape here, okay, which is suggestive if you're a relativist. So this is it's suggestive of a constant time hypersurface. This is a classical sequential growth model, CSG model. It's stochastic. Things are happening randomly, but classically, one at a time. The structure that's being built is two-dimensional. It appears to have a limiting shape, which looks Lorentz invariant. It does, in fact, have a limiting shape. You can prove that. It's not quite Lorentz invariant, so the real formula for that curve is given by this. Square root of u plus square root of v is 6t to the 1/4, where t is the number of blocks that you've dropped in, and u and v are the light cone coordinates, the way I've set it up. So this is a parabola. It's not a hyperbola. But we'll take this as inspiration, not as an actual model for something, okay? So as many of you maybe know, Raphael and David Rideout invented a classical sequential growth model for causal sets, which is different from this classical sequential growth model for this crystal that I just showed you. So I wanna tell you a little bit about the process that they invented. Before I do that, despite this being the Perimeter Institute, I have to have one or two slides about causal sets, just in case some of you are not familiar with that. Causal sets are a discrete approach to doing quantum gravity, where you take as the underlying structure, not a space-time manifold, but some discrete structure, which is a locally finite, partially ordered set. You should think about the partial ordering as being causality. And this approach is based on these theorems of Hawking and Malamud from the 70s, which say that if you have a space-time manifold and you extract from it all the points and just remember their causal relations, you can, from that information alone, reproduce the topology and the differentiable structure and the metric of the Lorentzian manifold up to a local conformal factor, or up to the volume form. And then Raphael observed in the, I don't know when, 80s probably, that you could reproduce this local conformal factor approximately if your discrete structure were finite and you could count the number of elements in some local volume. And that would give you, if they were distributed uniformly relative to the volume form of the metric, that would give you an estimate for what the local conformal factor is. So this justifies taking these locally finite. Locally finite just means that in each order interval, so take an element x and an element y, which is to its future, the intersection of their past and future should be finite. Okay. It justifies taking these locally finite partially ordered sets as the underlying structure of a theory which might turn out to be quantum gravity if you're clever enough. So more precisely, a causal set is a partial order, which means there's a relation which I've drawn as less than or equal to, squiggly. So each element is less than or equal to itself. If x is less than or equal to y and y is less than or equal to x, then x is equal to y. And if x is less than or equal to y and y is less than or equal to z, then x is less than or equal to z. And these are exactly the relations you would want to have for events in space-time which are causally related. Okay, and this should be true for all x, y, and z. And then sometimes we'll use the notation that if x is less than or equal to y, but x is not equal to y, then we just write x squiggly precedes y. Locally finite means the thing that I demonstrated with my fingers a minute ago. It's the for every pair x and y, if you count all the elements that lie in between them causally, the cardinality of that set should be some natural number, but should not be infinite. Okay. So the kinematics of causal sets, so what you might mean by their dimension, their topology, something about their geometry is reasonably well understood. It's not completely understood. There's more things to be done there, but there's some reasonable understanding. But we would like the theory to be dynamical, and it's been harder to write down reasonable dynamics for causal sets. Although over the past, well, you'll hear me talk about stuff that started 15 years ago, but then also over the past 5 years or so, there's been a different approach than the one I'm describing. So there are various proposals for this, and I'm going to talk about one of them. Okay. So first of all, I should say a little bit about what we would mean by a dynamics for causal sets. So if you're taking a sum over histories approach to quantum mechanics, you might be looking for an action functional, so some functional which takes each causal set and assigns to it a real number. And then if you have some set of causal sets, then the amplitude for that set should be a sum over all the causal sets of e to the minus I over h bar times this action function, where these are the causal sets which, for whatever reason, should be added coherently. More generally than this, you can say that a dynamics should be determined by some measure, some probability measure, on a sigma algebra over the set of causal sets, where the measure is defined not necessarily for all sets of causal sets, but for the subsets that correspond to observables. Okay. So for the purposes of today, this is what we're going to mean by a dynamics. We'll mean that we want to construct some sigma algebra and some measure. Okay. So David Rideout and Raphael defined such a measure by a sequential growth model, or classical sequential growth model, which is stochastic. And I'm going to describe how that works. It's not the same as that model for crystal growth, but there are some similarities which are suggested. So the way this works is, just as in that crystal growth model, maximal elements accrete one by one. So by maximal element, I mean a new element comes into the partially ordered set, and it attaches on, possibly, to some of the existing elements, but nothing that's already there lies to its future. Okay. So as this happens, the partially ordered set grows infinitely. So we end up, you know, as t goes to infinity, with an infinite, countably infinite, but past finite partially ordered set. Start with the empty set and start adding elements. So we can think about evolution in this CSG model as an infinite upward path from the empty set in the partially ordered set of causal sets, where the causal sets are ordered by C precedes C prime, if and only if you get to C prime from C by adding some maximal element. Okay. So here's a picture of that. So this is the empty causal set. This is the causal set with one element. This is two elements where they're causally, the second one comes to the causal future of the first one. These are two unrelated elements, etc. And I've drawn in this picture all the partially ordered sets up to four elements, okay, which is not very many elements if we're thinking about little pieces of space-time which are on the Planck scale. This is still a very tiny, tiny, tiny universe. Okay. So a particular instance of sequential growth would be some path through this partially ordered set of causal sets, where we add a maximal element at each time. So we start at the empty set, add an element. Now we add an element which is to the future of this one, add an element which is to the future of these two. Now add an element which is to the side of those two, side meaning spatially related. It's still a maximal element because there's no element to its future. Okay? So that's one instance. Here's another instance that could happen. Now the first element we add is unrelated to the second element we add is unrelated to the first. The third element is also unrelated. And then we add a fourth element, which is to the future of all of the existing ones. And then it continues up and up and up in this huge infinite partial order of causal sets. Okay. So to define a dynamics, we're going to be talking about some sigma algebra. What are the elements in the set that sigma algebra is defined on? Well, these are going to be equivalence classes of these kinds of semi-infinite paths. And they'll be equivalence classes where the paths at some point come together and then stay the same for infinite time. So they may divert at the beginning, but then at beyond some point, capital T, the two paths are the same. So we can define an equivalence class on the set of paths in this path, in this partially ordered set, by this condition. So David and Raphael attached a transition probability to each transition in this partially ordered set of causal sets, namely a transition probability to adding each possible element to an existing causal set. And these transition probabilities satisfied three properties. The first is a conservation of probability property, which says that if you look at all the transitions that can happen from a particular causal set, there's some finite number of transitions that can happen, the probabilities of each of those happening have to add up to one. We don't want to take the actual path that the stochastic process follows particularly seriously, because that's like assigning a time coordinate to the ultimate infinite past finite causal set that we end up with, because we would get a labeling of the elements there. We don't want to take that seriously because there shouldn't be a set of coordinates that's preferred. So the measure that gets attached to an equivalence class of these paths that end up being the same as they go off to infinity shouldn't depend on which representative element of that equivalence class you choose. And one way of achieving that is by enforcing this requirement that for every finite causal set, all the paths that get there from the empty set have the same probability. Okay? And by the same probability, I mean it's the product of the transition probabilities of adding one element at a time to get to that set C. Okay? So this will certainly make all the elements in this equivalence class have the same, well, infinite sequence of products of probabilities. And then finally, there's a causality condition, which they call Bell causality, which says that the relative probability of adding two different causal set new maximal elements should depend to a given causal set C, should depend only on the union of the pasts of those two new elements in C. Okay, so each of them attaches to the future of some set of the elements in C. That's the past of that element. Take the union of those two pasts. The relative probability of the two transitions should only depend on the structure of that union of pasts. Okay. Seems like a very sensible condition for causality. What happens when you add this element shouldn't depend on stuff that's not to its past, and the relative probability of two of them shouldn't depend on anything which is not to the past of at least one of them. Okay, so it turns out that these three conditions can be satisfied simultaneously. And a generic solution is given by a countable number of parameters. So we'll label these parameters W0, W1, W2, where W0 is taken to be 1. It doesn't really matter what's taken to, but it just means that the universe exists. So relative to these non-negative real numbers, the probability of a path from the empty set to a particular causal set C is given by a statistical mechanics model. So this should look like a probability to you. Z is going to be something like a partition function. Z is defined to be this quantity here, which depends only on the cardinality of the set C, some binomial coefficients, and the weights WK up to the cardinality of C minus 1. Okay. The statistical mechanics model that we compute this with is a model of Z2 valued spins on the relations in the causal set C. So for each relation X precedes Y, we assign some element of Z2. When we do that for all the relations, that's this map, sigma. And sigma is fixed to have the property that if there's nothing in between X and Y, sigma gives that relation a 1. Okay. So this probability then is the product over all the elements in the causal set C of this quantity, which is a weight, summed over all possible configurations, all possible assignment of spins. And this weight is one of these weights, and the index is this number that I've written as R of Y and sigma. It's going to depend on which assignment of spins we have and which element y we're talking about. And all this number r of y sigma is it's all the, it counts the number of relations that have a 1 on them that go down from y. Okay? So to show you a picture of this, here's a very small causal set. Here's an assignment of spins to the edges. This edge, there's nothing in between these, so that has to be a 1. Similarly, this has to be a 1. This has to be a 1. This has to be a 1. Between this edge, between this element and this element, there are actually 2 other elements in the causal set. So this is not fixed. This can be a 1 or a 0. If it's a 1, we're going to get the product over all the elements in the causal set of this weighting factor w, which depends on how many 1s go into that element. So this one has 3 1s going into it, so we get w sub 3. This one has 1 1 going into it, so we get w sub 1. This has 1 1 going into it, so we get w sub 1. So this is w3 times w1 squared. Or we could have a 0 on that edge, in which case we would get w2 for this one, and then w1 and w1 for those 2. So we get that. So that means each path to this causal set C, so each way of constructing this causal set C, has probability, the sum of those 2 things, which is w3 plus w2 times w1 squared. Okay, so finding and solving this model was, in my mind, sort of a tour de force of mathematical physics. I mean, it was, you had to define this set of constraints on this growth process, and then you had to find a solution to it, and remarkably, the solution exists, and you can write it down with a finite number of parameters, and then you can interpret it as this nice statistical mechanics model. It's a beautiful set of work, and various properties of this sequential growth model have been worked out by David and Raphael in connection with several other people over the years since this was first done in 1999, including most recently in the last few years by some philosophers of physics at UCSD who got interested in this and have been thinking about its sort of philosophical implications. So this is a beautiful model, but it has some problems. So one problem is, it seems to be difficult to get the output to look like a manifold, like a Lorentzian manifold. It's not impossible, but it seems to be impossible to get it to look like an interesting manifold. So it's easy to get it to look like a 0 plus 1 dimensional manifold in some limit, but that's not a very interesting manifold. And then, of course, it's not yet a quantum dynamics. It's just a classical dynamic. So I want to think about how we might change things a little bit to maybe solve these 2 problems. So now the speculation starts. So first, let me give a sort of heuristic argument for why it's hard to get things that look like manifolds here. So suppose the sequential growth process has grown at some stage a manifold-like causal set. So I've drawn it sort of like a two-dimensional manifold here because I can't draw bigger ones really. But and let's think about this arc that I've drawn there as it's like a Cauchy surface in this manifold. Okay? But this isn't really a manifold. This is really a zoomed out picture of a very dense set of points. Well, there's nothing to prevent another copy of this thing growing out from that same place. Because if a new element, you know, that's going to end up here comes in and is added to the causal set, it looks to its past, which is going to be, you know, something on this Cauchy surface or below. and it could grow just as well as the original one grew. The problem is that as the second copy starts growing, it doesn't know that the first copy is already there, because it can't look to the future. It can only look to the past of where it attaches. Okay. And the reason it can't is because the way the dynamics are defined, they have to satisfy this Bell causality condition, which says that the relative probabilities of things being added only depend on the pasts of where they get added to. This is not a proof of anything. It's just sort of a heuristic argument for why we might expect the result not to look like a manifold, because it can bifurcate like this, and then, of course, it doesn't any longer look like, in this case, a two-manifold. It looks like some, you know, spin foam or something. So what do we conclude from this? Well, maybe this Bell causality condition is too strong. Maybe it's ruling out stuff we would like to allow. So if we take seriously this statistical mechanics model that I described, which had spin variables on the relations, and we think about those spin variables as being matter of some kind, then the spin variable on some particular edge in the causal set corresponds physically to that matter propagating forward in time, going from one element to the next element. But that means, in particular, that that matter, that particle, was present at the bottom vertex when that bottom vertex existed. So what if we take that seriously? So that means that at any non-maximal element of a causal set C, the future-directed relations that come out of that element have matter on them. And that matter is on that element before it starts propagating forward. So the Bell causality condition was that the relative probability of two new elements attaching to past sets depended only on the union of those past sets. But now I'm saying, well, if we take this idea of matter propagating forward through the causal set seriously, there's already matter encoding, whose states are encoding what's happening afterwards at elements that are being attached to. So maybe we should replace this Bell causality condition with a weaker causality condition, a much, much weaker causality condition, which says that the relative probability of two new elements attaching to past sets in C depends only on the union of the futures of these past sets, because things in these past sets are connected to things in the future by these relations, and that means there's matter on them. And the new element can see that matter. So I say this is a weaker condition because if it depends on the union of the futures of these past sets, in particular, the case where it depends only on the past sets themselves is a special case of that. So the existing growth dynamics is perfectly allowed by this condition, but potentially new growth models will be allowed. So we can ask, with this much weaker causality constraint, can we grow something that looks like a 1+1 dimensional diamond causal set that looks kind of like the crystal that I showed growing in the condensed matter crystal growth model at the beginning? So here's a little lemma. If a causal set C in the evolution has a unique minimal element, then this weak causality condition imposes no constraints whatsoever on the relative probabilities of adding maximal elements to that causal set, because each past set in that causal set will have that unique minimal element in its past, and the future of that unique minimal element will be everything. So it will depend only on the whole causal set C, which can't have appeared anywhere earlier in the definition of the dynamics, so it's not going to constrain the probabilities at all. Okay, so let's do that. Let's set the probability of the transition from a single element to two unrelated elements to be equal to zero, so we don't go from one minimal element to two minimal elements. And then, in fact, let's set to zero the probabilities of ever adding an extra unrelated element. So we never add a second minimal element. So in this picture of the partially ordered sets of causal sets, lots of these transition probabilities will be set to zero. So this is going to be zero. That means everything up here is going to be zero. This is going to be zero, so this doesn't happen either. So the only things that happen are these things here. We don't even get to that one because that's going to have zero. So now I've stripped out all the stuff that can't happen, and I've redrawn the picture where we only keep the things that have a unique minimal element. And furthermore, I'm going to set to zero all the things that, all the transitions which go to things which are not stages in the growth of this diamond poset. Okay. So when I do that, the only things that are left are these black partially ordered sets here where I've drawn chains along the light cone just because I'm imagining that they're going to turn into this diamond poset eventually. So the question is, can we assign transition probabilities here which allow this thing to grow? In particular, can we choose transition probabilities that satisfy discrete covariance? So my color coding may not have been clear up until now, and this is the first time I've used orange. Orange means I don't know the answer. Okay. So it's an open question. I did some numerical calculations. The answer seems to be yes, but I don't have a theorem here. But maybe we don't need to satisfy discrete covariance either. So I already replaced Bell causality with much weaker causality. Maybe we don't need to enforce this discrete covariance condition either. It's certainly not true in the crystal growth model. So here's the analogous picture to the partial order of causal sets, which is now the partial order of stages of the crystal growth model. So there's a little square, can add one in this corner, can add one in this corner, et cetera. So each horizontal row here is constant number of the constant time step, okay? And the black lines indicate the allowed transitions. And In the crystal growth model, the probability of any allowed transition is the same. So from here to this, these are both transition probability a half. From here to this, they're both a half. From here to this, they're both a half. Here, there are three allowed transitions, so each of them is a third. And the probability of ending up at any particular stage along a particular path is given by the product of the probabilities to get there. And in particular, this one is going to, if we go along this path, it'll be a half times a half times a half to get to there. But if we go along this path, it'll be a half times a half times a third. And it's not the same probability according along those two paths. Okay. Well, that didn't bother us too much in the crystal growth model because we weren't trying to do something that was relativistic and in particular general relativistic, so we didn't really care about this condition. But still taking this as inspiration, let's remember that the condition that we impose here for discrete covariance was a sufficient condition for what we really wanted, but it wasn't, strictly speaking, a necessary condition. So what we wanted was that the measure attached to an equivalence class of these paths, or more precisely, the measure that's attached to an observable subset of these equivalence classes, shouldn't depend on the choice of time coordinate or representative in that equivalence class. And we enforced it by requiring that each causal set, every path that gets to it, has the same probability. But that's actually stronger than what we really need. So we could simply say the probability of getting a particular causal set is simply the sum of the probabilities of all the paths that get to it. And we're going to assign to an equivalence class of paths just the sum of all the paths that get to it. And then that's clearly not going to depend on any choice of representative in that set because we just add up all the probabilities. So we could define this. This is what I just said. We can define the probability of a causal set C to be the sum of the probabilities of the paths from the empty set to C. This is going to satisfy what we wanted just as well. And allows for more possible dynamics. And it kind of starts looking a little bit like quantum mechanics also at this point. So let's call this condition total discrete covariance and observe that it's no condition at all on the transition probabilities. So I didn't really explain why requiring things to be equal would give a constraint on the transition probabilities, but we can see that by looking at this picture. So I said that there's a probability of half, a half, a half, half times a half times a half times a half to get to here, half, a half, a third to get to here. But suppose we were trying to write down transition probabilities in this model, not insist that they all be equal coming out of each particular node in the set. Then we could say, well, we want to figure out what to assign to each of these. So, okay, we can assign these two to be equal. We can assign these four all to be equal without getting any constraints. But now when we try to decide what to assign to this, 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 and this, we're going to have a constraint, namely this times that has to be equal to this times that. So if we pick one of them, that'll control what the other one is. Okay. So the discrete causality condition controls the transition probabilities, but this total discrete covariance condition doesn't impose any constraints at all, because all we're going to do is we're not going to insist that the paths have the same probability. We're just going to assign a probability to the causal set, which is the sum of the probabilities of the paths that get there. Okay. So I don't mean to say that the original conditions are not sensible. They were very sensible. They had real physical meanings, and they had strong consequences, namely that they restricted the possible sequential growth dynamics to a relatively small family of models, if you think having a countably infinite number of parameters is a small family of models. Okay? That's smaller than a continuum of parameters, at least. Yeah, so that's the transitive percolation model, which is a particular case of these CSG models where there's one parameter and then all of these countably infinite parameters are functions of that parameter. I don't remember off the top of my head what the relationship is. I'm sure Raphael does, but so what's the relative to the transition probability in the is it just power? Yeah, which is related to the probability of adding a link. So. No, but that's the constraints allow many more than that. So those transitive percolation models, although they're nice, they don't particularly look like manifolds unless. unless this parameter gets really big. If it, as it goes to infinity, it looks like a 0 plus 1 dimensional manifold, which is a manifold, but not that interesting. Okay. So weakening the conditions the way I'm suggesting, you know, we lose the strong physical meanings that we had before, and we're going to get a much bigger family of models. So we're losing something by weakening them. But we gain the possibility that we're going to evolve causal sets that are manifold-like. In particular, you know, I showed that we could get the diamond coset, which is not the same as a random sprinkling of elements into 1 plus 1 dimensional Minkowski space, but it certainly looks like a 1 plus 1 dimensional manifold. Furthermore, we can now consider completely different families of models than we were considering previously. So going back to the crystal growth models, the description I gave of the elements accreting one at a time here, that's somehow like a zero temperature model where there's some lower energy of attaching and a higher energy associated with removing an element at the top of the crystal. But if you're at higher temperature, both of those processes happen with some probability. So not only do you go upwards as you add an element, but sometimes you go downwards as you as an element flies off into space. So we can study now random walks on this graph where we don't take these edges to be directed any longer. Okay. So here's what it looks like. So things, you know, start adding, but if you're counting very quickly to yourself, you'll see that, you know, since sometimes things go away, the total area here, the total number of little squares is smaller relative to the time than it was before, where it was exactly the same as the time. Okay. So this is growing. It still looks kind of the same as before in the sense that there seems to be, you know, it seems to be preferential to go along the edges, although maybe a little bit less so than before. It's not growing very fast. And if you think about this for a minute, you'll realize that it's just sort of a combinatorial fact that if you look at any possible, you know, future edge here, there's exactly one more place that you can add a square than a place from which you can delete a square. So that means as in the simulation I'm running here, each step in that graph was equal probability. So if we're allowed to add an element or delete an element, those things happen with equal probability. And there's, for each configuration, there's one more possibility of adding an element. So the probability of adding an element is always a little bit higher than deleting an element. But as this gets gets bigger and bigger, that difference gets smaller and smaller. So we expect this to, you know, accrete elements or add volume slower and slower as it gets bigger and bigger. Okay. So I don't know how much longer this is going to run, but I want to let it finish so we can take a look at what the shape looks like at the end. You can, and in fact, I'm going to show you the result of that rescaling in a second. So this is the end. So, you know, for this many time steps, we get something which, you know, hasn't grown as much as before, even though I did it, I think, for twice as many time steps, or possibly four times as many time steps, I can't remember. We have this interface which isn't as smooth as before, but it still sort of has this same feeling of looking a little bit like a hyperbola. Okay. So When the crystal only grows, the area below the interface is just t, because we've added t squares. Okay? When the transition probabilities upwards and downwards are equal to any allowed change of configuration are equal, then the expected area grows like order square root of t, because it becomes sort of like a random walk as you get to large numbers of possibilities of adding and subtracting. They're almost the same, so it grows like like a random walk grows, which is square root of t. And if the transition probabilities downward are a tiny bit bigger than the probabilities going upward, that means at some stage they overwhelm the going upward probabilities, and that means that there's actually a limiting value to the shape that you get. And the top curve is given by this equation, where A is goes like 1 over the square root of the area, and the area goes like 1 over epsilon squared. Okay. I didn't write down what the formula is in this case, but as Ray suggests, you can write down a rescaled version of this in time, and there's a sort of nasty formula for a nasty integral equation that it has to satisfy. Okay. So this one is easy to write down, and this one is easy to write down. That one's not so easy to write down. Okay, so now that this graph of allowed transitions is not directed, we could equally well define a quantum random walk on it as we could define a classical random walk on it. So just to remind you, a quantum random walk on a graph is defined using the adjacency matrix. So the adjacency matrix of the graph has rows and columns labeled by the vertices, and an element in the ijth position is 1 if there's a link between I and J, and it's 0 otherwise. And D is going to be the diagonal matrix, which has the degrees of the vertices as its diagonal elements. So the graph Laplacian is the adjacency matrix minus this diagonal matrix. On the line, on the discrete line, think of this as being ones on the super and sub-diagonal, and minus twos along the diagonal. So it's a discretization of the second derivative. Okay? And this is the analog of that for something which isn't necessarily, doesn't necessarily look like Euclidean space. Okay? Then we can define minus L to be a Hamiltonian. It's symmetric and it's positive. So then a quantum random walk evolution is just the Schrodinger equation with this Hamiltonian, where this the state vector psi takes its values in functions over the vertices, complex functions over the vertices. Okay. This is continuous time evolution, but that's the easier one to discuss here. So it's hard to study what this is going to look like on this, even on this partial ordering of possible stages of crystal growth. It looks not so bad only up to stage 4, but this thing grows faster and faster as we go up. Remember that we're going to have a dimension of the Hilbert space associated with each vertex, namely each of these configurations. So very quickly, it's going to be, you know, exponentially big Hilbert space. It's going to be hard for me to simulate the results on the computer. So I'm going to do a much easier case. I'm going to do the diagrams like this that have width 1, where width is defined in the v direction. So width 1 just means this, and this. Going up the side, okay? Or we could think of this as just a quantum random walk on the natural numbers, Okay, so it's not on the integers, it's on the semi-infinite thing. Okay. So what does this look like? Maybe some of you have looked at this before. What I'm plotting here is the probability as a function of the configuration. So the variable along here is in one-to-one correspondence with these just strings of squares, okay? So it starts at the beginning, at the left-hand end, and this is what it does. So it propagates outward. This peak appears to be traveling with constant velocity. If you plot the expected value of this wave, of this state vector, you find that that's increasing with constant velocity. So those are both numerical statements. They're not theorems. But that shows you what happens in this case. So the wave function, if you like, when we restrict just to here, propagates, it starts here, actually starts at the empty set, and then it propagates upward like this, more and more amplitude, leaving some tail behind, but the sort of most amplitude is, and most probability is moving upward to larger areas. This is a numerical solution of the continuous time, that's right. So that's a really easy numerical calculation. There's one more calculation which we might try to do, which is also relatively easy, which is to restrict ourselves just to things that have width 2 in the v direction. So if you think of these as partitions, this is things that have 2 parts or fewer. So it's this set here in this picture. So it doesn't include these because they have 3 parts or 4 parts. Okay. If you think about it for a minute, you'll realize that the set of partitions with 2 parts is in one-to-one correspondence with the points in the two-dimensional integer lattice that lie below the diagonal, because or between the x-axis and the diagonal, because the second part has to be smaller than or equal to the first part. So if you think about this number as being the x-coordinate and the number in the second part being the y-coordinate, we get things which are of the form y less than or equal to x. Okay. So I tried to do a little plot of this right before this. I'm not sure this is going to work, but okay. So this is that picture. So each point on the xy plane here corresponds to, each integer point on the xy plane here corresponds to one configuration of these 2-part partitions. And then the vertical axis again corresponds to probability, and we're starting with all the probabilities start at the empty set, and we're going to let the thing grow. Okay.
Or maybe not grow, we'll see. So there goes.
Didn't go very far because I didn't have time to run it before the talk. So there's a little ripple that's propagating largely along the diagonal, but partly not on the diagonal, and it's propagating outward. The amplitude and the probability is propagating to larger and larger sizes.
Okay, so just to summarize,
the two-dimensionality and the approximate, you know, visual Lorentz invariance of the crystal growth model suggests maybe we should reconsider the sequential growth constraints for causal sets. If we weaken the causality constraint and totalize the discrete covariance constraint, we find that we can in fact get sequential growth for the diamond causal set, the 1+1 dimensional causal set that looks like a diamond. These weaker constraints here are satisfied by the finite temperature crystal growth models, which suggests maybe we should think about random walks on the undirected post set of causal sets. So I didn't show you a simulation of that because I haven't done it, but we could take random walks on that configuration as well. That's even worse. That grows even faster than the partitions grow as you go up in size. So it's, you know, more painful to do any simulations. Not only can we consider random walks, but we consider quantum random walks on this undirected poset of causal sets. The two little simple examples that I showed you both had this property, that the derivative with respect to this time in which the evolution is happening, which I'm calling tau, of the expected past volume of the state, which we can think of as the derivative of the expected time, if we think about time in space-time as being defined by past volume. So the derivative of real time, of internal time, with respect to this external time was positive in expectation value. So maybe the real true unitary evolution that's happening is the unitary evolution with respect to this external time tau. And the fact that this derivative is positive lets us confuse t and tau when we're in situations where quantum gravity effects aren't important. So maybe when we've been looking for quantum gravity models that are unitary with respect to some internal time, maybe we've been looking in the wrong direction. Maybe we shouldn't have been thinking that. Maybe we should have been thinking all along that, well, there's this external time with respect to which the growth is unitary, and it just looks very close to being unitary when we're in the regime that we're in. So I have some thoughts about how to try to construct toy models for this, but they're not very well formed, and time is up, so I will stop here.
Okay, questions?
So it seems to me like you're suggesting that maybe there's a preferred time coordinate in causal sets, because you can always, well, in GR, time is arbitrary. You can, observers can define their own time. So, but you said this tau is basically essentially when, has to do with when each element was added to, is that right? Not quite the case, but.
So tau is the parameter with respect to which this quantum random walk is happening in the space of space-times.
Right.
So I didn't comment on this, but when it goes backward, that means that a little piece of our space-time got deleted. So, you know, if you were there, suddenly that didn't happen anymore. You didn't evolve through that little piece of space-time.
But in terms of observable, so basically what the idea is that you're gonna evolve this tau until some maximum, and then you get a space-time or you get the causal set.
Right.
And observers just live there, so they don't have any information about what happened at previous tau.
That's right.
Right. And so I guess that tau, so we have no knowledge of that in some sense.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
So then, I mean, what you mentioned here, I'm not quite sure how these two are related, because for a particular causal set, there is just one tau, or even not even that. So a particular causal set, there, somebody lives in a causal set. If I'm born in a causal set and die in one causal set, I have no way of, no information about what my tau is.
That's right.
Right? So how could I confuse, unitary evolution in T with unitary evolution in tau.
So I'm imagining that if we added matter to the mm-hmm. causal set so that there could be someone who lives and dies in the causal set, mm-hmm. constructed of matter, that the unitary evolution of that causal set with matter on it relative to this parameter tau might look relative to T in the mm-hmm. causal set defined by past volume, mm-hmm. it might look like almost unitary evolution of the matter mm-hmm. in cases where quantum gravity effects are not supposed to be big. And so so to say a little bit about what the thoughts I have about making a model like that, so imagine just the simple one-dimensional model that I showed you the first mm-hmm. simulation of. So suppose you have a Z2 matter field on that. So what that means is you're going to have decorations of each of those configurations by a bit string. So you're going to replace the chain that goes from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 length things. You're going to replace that with a graph on bit strings, where transitions happen from a bit string with length t to length t plus 1, or the reverse. And we would have some unitary process happening on that, controlled by tau. And the question is, what would that look like relative to an internal measure of t in that case, which would be the length of the bit string? And the idea would be that because t and tau are so closely related, the expectation value of t is increasing linearly with tau, it might be that it looks like it's unitary with respect to t, even though it's really unitary with respect to tau, or very close to being unitary with respect to t. So that's the idea. It's a wild speculation at this point.
Okay, thanks. Just another wild speculation to add to that. Do you think something like this could have to do with the unitarity of black hole evaporation? So, you know, at some point at the end of black hole radiation, you worry about information going missing. Could it be that rather than the information going missing, you're using this different time coordinate, you're really deleting bits of space or something? Could you speculate on that?
Yeah, so I mean, I know people have thought about external times before, and that's basically what I'm arguing, that we shouldn't expect unitarity of black hole evolution in our space-time. We should expect unitarity of black hole evolution in this graph of possible space-times. That's where the unitarity is happening. It's not happening in our own one.
Any more questions? Okay, then let's thank David again.